You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Obvious, Scurvy Legs, Brendan, Kruger, MD, Big Beard, Willie P, Schmarls, Josiah, Logan, Pablo, Cannon Monkey, Axios, Jack Joyce, The Knight of Dampier, Lost Again, The Navigator, Governor Roop, Gin-Soaked Jim, Ward, Workman, Rum Runner, Skipper, Drunken Deck, Eric the Red, The Pirate Nopales, Heyfei, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And I'd like to welcome our newest patrons, John, Lord Batboy, and Shantyman, and our newest Commodore, Ironside. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. Today we're going to end with Thomas II and his return to America. I promise we're getting there, but there are a few stories that inform the tale of Thomas II. I'm going to blame this on one of our patrons, Don. He was interested in the connections that can be drawn between pirates and the rest of the English naval world. Because he said something nice, and because I have a giant ego, I can't ignore the connections that are found in today's story. They're the kind of connections that can be found everywhere. The English maritime community just wasn't that big, and as interest and fear of pirates grew in the late 17th century, sources grew more numerous, and those webs of connections grow even larger. So to get started today, we're going to discuss a few pirates who never matched the infamy of a Thomas II or a Henry Every, but who were almost as active on the pirate round. This is episode 201, A Very Pleasant Man. James Allison's career was relatively minor. We've mentioned him before, but don't feel bad if you don't remember. His career looks not unlike dozens of other small-timers. We do know a bit about him, though, thanks to a testimony from one of his victims. This all started with Samuel Shrimpton, out of Massachusetts. You might remember Shrimpton as well. He challenged a court decision in Massachusetts that ruled against him in a land dispute. It very nearly delegitimized the government of Massachusetts in the wake of Edmund Andros. But by 1691, Samuel Shrimpton was running a profitable shipping business. He hired a ship called the Good Hope under a Captain Jeremiah Tay to collect salt in the Cape Verde Islands. This should have been a quick, simple, and relatively profitable jaunt. When they arrived at the Cape Verde, Good Hope laid anchor at what Captain Tay calls the Island of May, probably the Isla de Mayo. There they were to collect salt, to rake it into their crates, and they spent several days at work when, according to Captain Tay, quote, "Upon the first day of February, there came into the road a sloop, wearing their Majesty's colors, Captain One James Allison, formerly of New York. They had a commission to take and endamage the French, for which they were here arrived. Captain Allison and his company were well known to us, having been logwood cutters in the Bay of Campeche." End quote. About a year previously, Good Hope made a run down to Campeche to buy logwood, and while they were there, the crew of Good Hope fraternized with James Allison and his men, who were cutting the logwood. They were, quote, eating, drinking, and lodging frequently on board our ship, which we gladly consented to, that they might have been a defense and help to us if any enemy had assaulted us. End quote. Since these privateers under Captain Allison had plenty of guns and a commission to attack the French, they were a welcome sight. Captain Tay thought that they would protect his ship should a French privateer appear, which was a real concern at this point. Even though the heyday of the buccaneers was over, legitimate French privateers controlled most of the Atlantic, the North Atlantic especially. But their tactics had changed. They weren't buccaneer raids. Instead of firing off a salvo and sending over a boat of bloodthirsty, saber-wielding, knife-in-the-teeth, musket-firing killers, they sent accountants. Now, those knife-in-the-teeth killers were still aboard the French privateers, but they stayed their hand. Instead of killing their way through the crew and taking everything on board, those accountants would sit down to share a mug of wine with the captain. There, they would go over the ship's ledgers. The privateers took most of the cargo, but ensured that they would leave enough to pay back the ship's investors, and maybe even a little to take something home. It was a tactic that killed English profits for a couple of years, but what captain out on the ocean would resist something like this? Almost no one did. Still, though, none of that was of concern for Captain Tay, because he had a friendly privateer around to protect him, so why would he worry? Once again, Captain Tay invited Captain Allison and his crew over to Good Hope to drink and fraternize. This was friendly, sure, but Captain Tay did have a motivation here. Once all of those privateers were aboard his ship, he was free to send all of his men out to collect salt. In his mind, they didn't even need a skeleton crew around to guard Good Hope because of all of these privateers. But while all of his men were away, according to Captain Tay, quote, they then fired a gun as a signal to the sloop, who seized us and forthwith weighed anchor and laid our ship aboard. At the same time, taking everything out of the sloop, excepting a little stinking brackish water, some flour, a little stinking beef, and 3 or 4 bags of wheat. End quote. He's saying that while the men of Good Hope were away, the privateers on board her fired off a shot. Then the rest of the privateers on board the sloop unloaded almost everything except for a bit of disgusting food that was going to be left to the men who were currently collecting salt. Benjamin Blackledge, one of James Allison's men who was on trial here when this testimony was taken, recalls, quote, the Good Hope, Jeremiah Tay commander, did wickedly, feloniously, and piratically rise up in rebellion against Master Jeremiah Tay. James Allison, a pirate or sea rover, master of a sloop, and his company did conspire, abet, and join with his company to seize, surprise, and piratically take from him the ship Good Hope. End quote. That's a confession, but it also points some of the blame to the crew of the Good Hope, which was likely true, and it appears that Benjamin Blackledge did avoid the hangman thanks to that confession. Still, he was convicted and put to work aboard a naval vessel, which wasn't usually much better than execution. Now, we don't know the fate of James Allison. We'll never hear from him again. But we do know that at least some of his men made it from the Cape Verde Islands all the way around the Cape of Good Hope to St. Augustine Bay on Madagascar. We know this because Adam Baldridge, our best source for everything on Madagascar, tells us so. The second pirate to arrive at St. Mary's, after George Rayner and Bachelor's Delight, according to Adam Baldridge, was someone that we met last time named Edward Coates. He arrived at St. Mary's on the 14th of October, 1692. Now, most of what Baldridge tells us here comes from his ledgers, a record of food and tools and powder and shot. But it does give us a bit of a hint about Coates' voyage. You'll recall from last time that Edward Coates arrived at Rhode Island to join up with William Mason, Robert Culliford, and Samuel Burgess, three pirates who had mutinied against Captain Kidd. Coates and his men signed up under Culliford to sail on board the Jacob. Culliford was the newest captain in the fleet and was light on men, so a couple of dozen extra were a blessing. And it's here the details start to grow scant. We know that these pirates made it to St. Augustine Bay. There they signed up some of the stranded crew of James Allison. Adam Baldridge never mentions Allison or Good Hope by name. Both were long gone at this point, but he does name Samuel Shrimpton and his cargo. Then we lose track of Mason and Culliford, of Burgess and Coates for about a year. We can assume that their crews looked similar to that of Thomas too, riding the Indian Ocean wind currents in a big circle until finally they arrive at India. To be specific, we know they arrived at a village called Mangrol on the west coast of India, deep in Mughal territory. Mangrol is pretty big today, but at the time was little more than a sleepy fishing village. The pirates went ashore and ransacked the place. There was plunder and murder and fire, nothing unexpected. What is surprising, though, is the force of Mughal soldiers that arrived on the scene. When the pirate raid was winding down, when their lusts were finally sated, a force of Mughal cavalry arrived and tore through them. They killed or captured more than half of the pirates in Mangrol. Robert Culliford, captain of the Jacob, was arrested and imprisoned. Now, we will meet Culliford again, but for now, he's going to spend the next couple of years in a Mughal prison. William Mason's vessel, the Horn, was either burned or captured in the fighting. Those pirates that survived and escaped, including Samuel Burgess, William Mason, and Edward Coates, they fled India aboard the Jacob. And then, a few weeks later, Jacob arrives at St. Mary's with Edward Coates in command. At some point between India and Madagascar, the crew elected a captain. I mean, they had to. Their captain was just arrested. But it's interesting that they didn't choose William Mason. He'd just lost his own ship, but instead they chose Edward Coates. Beyond that, we don't know much. Baldridge is light on the details. We don't know, for example, if William Mason and Samuel Burgess were there at St. Mary's with Edward Coates. I mean, probably they were. Where else were they going to stop in the region? But reports of their activity do begin to differ here. There is a mention of Burgess in London in early 1693. Apparently, Robert Culliford, who we know is in a prison in India at this time, but this record tells us that Culliford was stopped in London for causing a drunken ruckus. He was raging about a betrayal by his quartermaster, Samuel Burgess. Now, that didn't happen. Culliford was in India, but maybe that wasn't Culliford. Now, I've never been questioned by the police for causing a drunken ruckus. I mean, that's just not the kind of thing I would do. But if I were in such a situation, I might just give the police a false name. And maybe the first name to pop into my head would be somebody I know. It's not impossible, to my mind, that William Mason was drunkenly raging in the streets of London and gave his name as the one guy he knew was not there. If that's the case, that betrayal by Samuel Burgess couldn't have been too bad. Maybe a row over a card game. Because in the spring of 1693, the Jacob arrived in New York. Edward Coates was still in command, and some of what Baldridge says can be corroborated here. The prize money these pirates earned from the roughly 15 months at sea amounted to about £500 a man. Now, there is no record of William Mason or Samuel Burgess aboard the Jacob when it arrived in New York, but they definitely arrived in America at just about this same moment. Edward Coates, though, who was the one pirate captain on that cruise that William Kidd had no reason to despise, Edward Coates was welcomed home. Governor Benjamin Fletcher and, presumably, William Kidd rolled out the red carpet for him. But we'll get back to Edward Coates and William Mason and Samuel Burgess in just a minute. For now, Thomas, too, is about to arrive. When we left Thomas II, he was at the end of a 15-month-long cruise around the Pirate Round, a voyage that took he and the pirate crew aboard the Amity from Rhode Island to Bermuda, around the Cape of Good Hope to St. Augustine Bay. Then a jaunt around the Indian Ocean. It looked a lot like what Mason had probably just done. This is what pirates were doing here. It was the Pirate Round. But the big difference between William Mason and Thomas II and the Amity was how it ended. Thomas II and his men made it to the Gate of Tears, that strait between the Red Sea and the open ocean. It was there that Amity captured a rich ganja dhow, belonging to the Grand Mughal's own family. It was a singularly rich prize. Then Thomas II stopped off at Adam Baldridge's Haven on St. Mary's, and finally, on the 23rd of December, 1693, they set sail for home.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Now, Amity was still technically owned by a bunch of investors in Bermuda. Thomas II and Amity may have embarked on a pirate cruise, but those investors still wanted their ship and their investment back. But Thomas II did not stop in Bermuda. If we were to believe Thomas II here, it's because the Amity suffered a terrible storm, a gale that jumped out of nowhere. A squall that nearly took down their mast in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. To save the Amity and the lives of every man on board, they furled the sails, they battened the hatches, and the ship was blown off course. Once the storm cleared, there was no way for Amity to return to Bermuda. Now, this is possible, plausible, even. The time of year and the location of the Amity, storms were a problem. It could be tough to make Bermuda from the South Atlantic in the best of times. The eastern seaboard of America was much easier. So I'm not saying that this didn't happen, but it is awfully convenient. See, the people of Bermuda probably would not have arrested the pirates. They were, after all, a corrupt island in the Atlantic that thrived on pirate booty, but they would have expected a cut, a percentage of the take, and that would have been fine under normal circumstances. But after that ganja dhow, well, that was a lot of money. At least 1,000 pounds sterling for every man on board, in some cases more like 2,300 pounds. In total, well over 100,000 pounds. Hard coin, remember, real plunder. That's hard to hide on board a ship. So it's lucky that the storm blew Amity off course and the men there in Bermuda would not be able to see how much plunder they had on board. Instead, the Amity first put down anchor at Providence, Rhode Island, Thomas Tu's hometown. Now there in Providence he had a wife and maybe even a few kids. There was probably a warm welcome for Thomas Tu in Providence, but the governor was less welcoming. Our old friend, John Easton, the pirate-hating Quaker governor of Rhode Island. This guy... Look, there are a ton of letters from Governor Easton back to London in which he tattles on William Phipps or Benjamin Fletcher or any of half a dozen different governors in America for the crime of harboring pirates, which, you know, to be fair, they were doing it. But I kind of feel for John Easton here. Every few months, a ship full of scallywags shows up on his doorstep with a huge bribe looking for a favor. It was only a few months before Thomas Tu arrived that William Mason and Samuel Burgess arrived in Providence. At almost exactly the same time that the Jacob arrived in New York, by the way. But Easton, as he was wont to do, sent Mason and Burgess packing. Now, William Mason and Samuel Burgess did eventually secure a commission from Benjamin Fletcher, but I don't know that they actually went to New York. They may have just sent a messenger. Thomas Tu, though, was confident that he would be able to get that favor out of Governor Easton. After all, he was a landowning family man with roots in Rhode Island. The governor was certain to hear him out. And to be fair to the governor, he did. When Tu arrived to ask him for a new commission, Governor Easton asked him exactly where he planned to use that commission. That's a softball of a question. Oh, right here, sir. I'm just going to patrol the waters off the coast for enemy ships to protect the glorious Commonwealth of Providence. That's what you're supposed to say. And, you know, if you happen to spot a French vessel out there on the blue and chase it down to, I don't know, the Windward Passage or the coast of Africa or some other rich shipping lane, well, you're just doing your patriotic duty in that case, right? But that's not how Thomas Tu answered the governor. I don't know if he wasn't familiar with Quaker sensibilities, or maybe he just thought he had the money and the clout to do as he wished, but instead of giving a politic answer to this very simple question, Thomas Tu replied, quote, where perhaps the commission might never be seen or heard of, end quote. David F. Marley tells us in Pirates of the Americas that Captain Tu made that reply darkly. It might not be clear what Thomas Tu was saying there. Were a French vessel boarded by English privateers, they would demand to see the letter of marque. They had to. They had to record who took their cargo. Those were the rules. Otherwise, it was pirates, which they would register, or the captain of the ship that was attacked would fall under suspicion. It was one of the laws of naval engagement. Thomas Tu, though, was saying that he would take his commission somewhere that people were less likely to ask to see his commission. In conjunction with a bag of 500 pounds in Muslim gold bearing the face of the Grand Mughal, well, the implication is clear. You don't need to worry about where I'll be going because I'm never going to have to show that commission to anybody. And I'll return in a year or so with an even bigger bag of this same gold. Naturally, any good governor would jump at this kind of opportunity. They're not going to say no because of the implication. It gives the government plausible deniability and a large sum of money. I mean, who would say no? Well, deeply moral, ethical, and religious Quakers is who. Governor John Easton was uncomfortable enough employing even legal privateers to defend his people. But this was beyond the pale. Thomas Tu and the crew of the Amity and Thomas Tu's family were all suddenly very much aware that they had to leave Rhode Island immediately. Within the week, they were on their way to New York. Thomas Tu received a much warmer welcome from Benjamin Fletcher. Reportedly, the governor met Amity at the dock and personally welcomed Thomas Tu to New York. According to later reports, Governor Fletcher, quote, entertained him and drove him about in his coach, though too publicly declared that he would make another voyage to the Red Sea and make New York his port of return. End quote. That carriage ride was the first of many. They became something of a tradition for the pirate and the governor. Over the next few months, they often rode through the streets of New York, openly declaring their friendship. And this is worthy of note. At least two totally independent sources make special note of these rides. Douglas R. Burgess, Jr. writes in The Pirate's Pact, quote, "What was so significant about these carriage rides? Clearly, Fletcher not only entertained the pirate, but did so openly, notoriously. Neither man was making any secret of his friendship with the other. For those irate observers who would later call piracy and illegal trade, quote, the beloved twins of the merchants of New York, end quote, such obvious display added insult to injury, end quote. The governor, after receiving a fabulous bribe, dropped Two and his family at a fine house near his own, not a permanent residence, but somewhere to stay. That's where Thomas Two got his financial and legal affairs in order. He wrote a letter to his investors back in Bermuda explaining the storm and his arrival in New York, rather than where he should have made landfall. They were upset, especially since Thomas Two made it clear he was keeping the Amity. That was their ship, and they wanted it returned. But the blow was softened somewhat when the messenger that Two sent handed over several thousand pounds of Mughal gold, enough to buy a new ship and to line all of their pockets. The investors informed Two that they weren't going to seek any kind of retribution, legal or otherwise, but it would be best if he stayed away from Bermuda from now on. Now, Governor Benjamin Fletcher was already on the take. He would take bribes from any scurrilous scallywag that came along, but it wasn't yet a widely publicized scandal. But that bribe that Thomas Two gave him, coupled with Two's infamy, changed everything there. This whole affair in New York between the pirate and the governor was the topic of pamphlets and newspapers and gossip rags and official inquiries. See, there does seem to have been some genuine friendship between Thomas Two and Benjamin Fletcher. The governor described Two as, quote, what they call a very pleasant man, so that at some times, when the labors of my day were over, it was some divertissement as well as information to me to hear him talk. End quote. And when he says divertissement, Fletcher means what we might call a diversion. He's saying that he would have Thomas Two and his family over, and they would regale him with tales of daring do on the high seas. The most famous image of Thomas Two is a drawing by Howard Pyle of the governor and the pirate enjoying their pipes, sitting next to a window. Two is smiling and gesturing. He's got a rogue's uniform on, complete with earrings and a bandana, and he's lit by the sun. Fletcher, on the other hand, is wearing lace at his cuffs and his collar and much better dressed, but he's hidden in shadow. Thomas Two's bribe to the governor bought his friendship and the protection of New York, but most importantly, a brand new commission. On the 2nd of November, 1694, at Fort William, Governor Fletcher and Thomas Two signed a new privateering commission. That commission was signed by an officiant whose name I'm not going to trouble you with, and by a bondsman named, wait for it, Edward Coates. By this point, Edward Coates had a minor role in New York government. Now, of course, he was questioned back when he arrived in New York. He had holds full of treasure. They're not going to let some pirate in, after all. But what magistrate do you imagine it was who sat in judgment of Edward Coates? He was a stern man. He had a black robe and one of those long, curly white wigs. And his name was William Kidd. Now that would not have been shocking at the time. Kidd was, after all, a respectable man with a wealthy wife and a very nice house in New York. but it's with hindsight that we can see what a deeply corrupt pirate paradise New York had become. The governor, on the take from everybody, appointed William Kidd to sit in judgment of Edward Coates, who therefore signed off on Thomas too. Beyond that, you've got the business community in New York. Naturally, the ale houses and the wine houses and the rum sinks and the gambling dens and the brothels, all of the traditional pirate businesses, they were bustling all across the city, but even more respectable businesses. Hatters and clothiers and architects and grocers, everybody was making money off of pirate booty. All of which started with William Kidd. Now, he was a respectable man here. He was a burgher. He was a magistrate. The most famous image of William Kidd is an image of him in those black robes with that long curly wig. And if things had not gone the way they did for William Kidd, it's not out of the question he might have had descendants on, you know, the Supreme Court or the White House, even. Most of the biographies I have of Captain Kidd point to the arrival of Thomas II as the moment that everything changed for him. Robert Ritchie, in his book Captain Kidd and the War Against the Pirates, points to Thomas II showing up with a chest full of gold and the smell of the sea on him as the moment that Kidd felt the call to adventure. But I could point, possibly, to an even more specific moment that it all could have changed. Shortly after Thomas II arrived in New York, Governor Fletcher threw a party. A big party, a ball. Now, New York was not Versailles, so don't picture something too extravagant, but New York was one of the largest and richest and least religious cities in English America, and it was currently filled with pirates. I picture the cream of New York society, perfumed and dressed in last year's finest finery, mingling with a few dozen freshly bathed, freshly shaved ne'er-do-wells, wearing nice new coats, not the best, but nice nonetheless. But the illusion would have been dashed thanks to their scars, their eye patches, their tattoos, and their earrings. And think about how these pirates would have walked, dressed as well as they had probably ever been dressed in their lives. But they had that awkward swagger that people who spend most of their time at sea tend to adopt. Plus, none of these guys wore shoes most days. If they wore shoes at all, it was hemp sandals, but for a shindig like this, they would have had on buckled, heeled shoes. I imagine a bunch of fierce killers and hard drinkers slinking around sheepishly among all of these mannered men and women of New York society. That is, at least until they've put a few drinks in them. Then maybe they'd put on a bit of a show for the upper crust. But what I'm really fascinated by is what happened between Thomas II and Captain Kidd at this party. This was a party thrown in honor of Thomas II and the crew of the Amity. Kidd was there. This could have been at Captain Kidd's house. We don't know. But at some point, Governor Fletcher would have introduced the two captains, if indeed they didn't know each other already. And what do you talk about in that situation? I imagine that the capture of the richest prize in decades probably came up between them. Maybe Captain Kidd talked about his adventures in the West Indies, and maybe they talked about what Thomas II had planned next. I will say that Captain Kidd is not going to accompany Thomas II on his next voyage, but he will eventually hunt him. This party, though, it was talked about. It was written about all over the English-speaking world. It was a scandal. Everyone who had talked about the pirate and the governor saw this as the worst sort of extravagance. We talked last time about the politics that were digging their claws into the pirate world, and all of that is on display here. The Whigs, back in London, latched on to this party in New York. Their newspapers wrote extensively about Thomas II and what they claimed was his very, very close personal friend, Governor Fletcher. And those newspapers flew off the stands. Everybody was reading about the riches of the Orient enjoyed in a bacchanal of drink and presumably loose women at a party attended by the governor. It was shocking to all. It promoted that perfect mix of shock, disgust, and envy that moves papers like nothing else. And those English newspapers made their way, via a number of wives and mothers, to the coast of Spain. Those women were visiting their family, currently stranded in a Spanish port with the Spanish expedition, including one young former Navy man named Henry Every. Thomas Tew's return to America could arguably be called the defining moment, the seminal moment in the golden age of piracy. That ganja dhow that he captured was far and away the best prize taken in years, and Thomas Tew's time in New York publicized it beyond any other pirate raid ever. We've seen a bunch of pirates roving the pirate round thus far, but for most of them, unless you are a particular pirate enthusiast, most people don't know their names. But Thomas Tew, William Kidd, Henry Every, these names are famous. And in the English-speaking world, they might be called the very first celebrities. In the wake of all of this scandal, all of this infamy, all of this publicity, we're going to see everything change. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, all of our patrons on Patreon, everybody who has left us ratings or reviews wherever you listen to the show, and everybody who has recommended us. You all make this possible. Thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.